ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 12, Text 11, Translation and Commentary by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Hridindriyanya Survyoma
Hridindriyanya Survyoma
Vayuragni Jalang Mahi Suryaschandrastapaschaiva
Suryaschandrastapaschaiva
Sthananyagre Kritanite
Sthananyagre Kritanite
Sthananyagre Kritanite. This should be pronounced Sthananyagre, not Sthananyagre. When it's recited as a verse, and should be pronounced Sthananyagre. Go ahead. Next. That also. Hridindriyanya Survyoma. One flowing sound, not stopping in the middle. Not Hridindriyani Asurvyoma. No. The y should flow into the next letter, not that there's any break in between. It's pronounced as a... It's pronounced y, not i-a. Hridindriyanyasur. Hridindriyanyasur, not Hridindriyani asur. Try again. No. Someone else can explain, try to explain the difference between the two. It's not the first who's doing this. That's why I'm making an issue of it. Others have also done it. Someone else can chant that. Say what is the difference? When the word is pronounced, when we read it word by word, it'll be Indriyani. But when it flows, it's as one, it becomes one word. Indriyani asur. Can you hear the difference? Indriyani asur. Indriyani asur. Can you hear the difference? Can everyone hear the difference? Can you hear the difference? You also did the wrong thing. Hridindriyani asur. Try again. Okay. All right. Forget it. Practice some other time. Find out from someone who knows. Get training. It's a
problem is with English.
No, even if you read it with the English, once having been told, what the speaker being told three or four times, you should be able to understand. This is Lord Brahma speaking to Rudra, who is newly born, from in between the eyebrows of Brahma. So the translation. My dear boy, I have already selected the following places for your residence. The heart, the senses, the air of life, the sky, the air, the fire, the water, the earth, the sun, the moon, and austerity. Purport. The creation of Rudra from between the eyebrows of Brahma as the result of his anger. Brahma's anger, generated from the mode of passion, partly touched by ignorance, is very significant. In Bhagavad Gita, the principle of Rudra is described. Krodh, anger, is the product of karma, lust, which is the result of the mode of passion. When lust and hankering are unsatisfied, the element of krodh appears, which is the formidable enemy of the conditioned soul. This most sinful and inimical passion is represented as ahankar, or the false egocentric attitude of thinking oneself to be all in all. Such an egocentric attitude on the part of the conditioned soul, who is completely under the control of material nature, is described in Bhagavad Gita as foolish. The egocentric attitude is a manifestation of the Rudra principle in the heart, wherein krodha, anger, is generated. This anger develops in the heart and is further manifested through various senses like the eyes, hands and legs. When a man is angry, he expresses such anger with red-hot eyes and sometimes makes a display of clenching his fists or kicking his legs. This exhibition of the Rudra principle is the proof of Rudra's presence in such places. When a man is angry, he breathes very rapidly, and thus Rudra is represented in the air of life or in the activities of breathing. When the sky is overcast with dense clouds and roars in anger, and when the wind blows very fiercely, the Rudra principle is manifested. And so also when the sea water is infuriated by the wind, it appears in a gloomy feature of Rudra, which is very fearful to the common man. When fire is ablaze, we can also experience the presence of Rudra. And when there is an inundation over the earth, we can understand that this is also the representation of Rudra. There are many earthly creatures who constantly represent the Rudra element. The snake, tiger, and lion are always representations of Rudra. Sometimes because of the extreme heat of the sun, there are cases of heat stroke, and due to the extreme coldness created by the moon, there are cases of collapse. There are many sages empowered with the influence of austerity, and many yogis, philosophers, and renouncers who sometimes exhibit their acquired power under the influence of the Rudra principles of anger and passion. The great yogi Durvasa, under the influence of this Rudra principle, picked a quarrel with Maharaj Ambarisha, and a Brahmana boy exhibited the Rudra principle by cursing the great King Parikshit. When the Rudra principle is exhibited by persons who are not engaged in the devotional service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the angry person falls down from the peak of his improved position. This is confirmed as follows. Yen ye ravindaksha vimuktamaninas tvayasta bhavad avishuddha buddhayaha aruhya kritrena parang padang tatav patantyadho nadrita yushmadangraha. The most lamentable fall down of the impersonalist is due to his false and unreasonable claim of being one with the Supreme. I'm informed there was an experience of the Rudra principle this morning before Mangalati in the form of a dangerous black snake called in English Kreet. What do you call that in local language? That kind of snake, that black snake, very dangerous, was in the Brahmachari ashram. Now, a cobra, if you're bitten by a cobra, there's a chance of surviving. But if you're bitten by this snake, there's no chance. Most dangerous. Not as common as cobras, but so wanted to be a Brahmachari, but is not in the right life form. So was sent off to another body. But very dangerous. Very dangerous, the snake. This kind of snake is very dangerous. That represents the Rudra principle, because the snake is very cruel. Sarpa krurat kala krurat. Sarpat krurata krurata kala. This Chanakya Pandit states, Srila Prabhupada sometimes quoted that, that a snake is very cruel. Envious, because may just bite someone without any reason and kill them, apparently without any reason. And an envious person is also very dangerous, but more so than a snake, because mantro shadiva sarpa. By mantras or by some kind of medicine, the snake can be brought under control. But kala, what is that? Kalakena Nivaryati, something like that. Means an envious person, there's nothing you can do with them to change their nature. So yeah, the snake, just by the look on the face, they look very angry. Crocodiles, they have this perpetual in their eyes, they have this look in their eyes, which means they're just ready to, they're very envious looking, very ready to snap you up at any moment. Cats also have that in their eye to some extent. So they are a personification of the Rudra principle, or anger. Of course, anger is not inherently bad. We don't blame Nrsimhadev for being angry. And Krishna blamed Arjuna for not being angry in a certain circumstance. But meaningless violence, vritahimsa, which is a symbol, symptom of Kali Yuga, that is something not at all good. If there had been a devotee bitten this morning, we'd have all been very sorry. But what to speak of, if one person dies due to the envy of one creature, then it is something that we'll be very sorry about. What about wars in which humans go, they may wander throughout the country and fighting each other and killing, something very horrible, much worse. Not just one snake, but the continual killing. It may be a war, or it may be some genocidal action. In the Western world, they make a big deal out of the Holocaust, the killing of what we're told 6 million Jews and others during the Second World War. There have been other such horrible things in Bangladesh in 1971, what is now called Bangladesh. The Pakistani army was wandering throughout the country with practically no resistance. No one could resist them. They're big, strong Punjabis, as was the Bengalis are short and not very strong. And they just go through villages and kill people and rape and burn the villages. And there's something very horrible. It's all the Rudra principle. Why should that be? Another question might be, why are we discussing it here in this peaceful, it's not even a village, it's an ashram. It's a very peaceful situation. Of course, it's not always been peaceful here. There's been much, even in the short history of this small ashram, there's been some manifestation of the Rudra principle, not in form of physical violence, but in form of argumentation, dispute, bad feeling, which is at the present time, the issues are not all resolved, but it's not manifest in our day-to-day lives. So why are we discussing this? Well, war could happen anytime, or a similar thing. We don't know, we don't expect it, but the whole social situation can change very quickly overnight. And also because our devotees should understand these points, especially because actually our devotees should understand everything and be able to explain everything. Yomam eva samudho janati purushottamam sasarvavid bhajati mam sarvabhavena bharata. Krishna tells Arjuna that a person who accepts Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead without doubting knows everything, and therefore he worships me fully. So a devotee should know everything, not to the extent that Krishna knows everything, but he should understand the principle of everything. And this is the fact that there is widespread suffering in the world is, from the foolish atheist point of view, a devastating indictment of belief in God, that If there's God, then there shouldn't be any suffering. So why are there wars or something extremely horrible? So let's discuss that. Lord Shiva, the Rudra principle, how does that manifest? Well, here's a quotation from a purport of Srila Prabhupada's in the fourth canto. He writes, Lord Shiva is always accompanied by his material energy, Shaktyaghoraya. I read this the other day in the Durga Puja discussion. Material energy, goddess Durga or goddess Kali, is always under his control. Goddess Kali and Durga serve him by killing all the asuras or demons. Sometimes Kali becomes so infuriated that she indiscriminately kills all kinds of asuras. There is a popular picture of goddess Kali in which she wears a garland composed of the heads of the asuras and holds in her left hand a captured head and in her right hand a great karga or chopper for killing asuras. Great wars are symbolic representations of Kali's devastation of the asuras and are actually conducted by the goddess Kali. So Srila Prabhupada in the purport that we read today says this is wars and violence and tsunamis and hurricanes and earthquakes and volcanoes and all these, as well as snake bites on the localized level, they're all manifestations of the Rudra principle or anger, which appears to have no meaning behind it whatsoever. So here also, Srila Prabhupada writes that great wars are conducted by the goddess Kali. So husband and wife team, they are overseeing all these things. And then Srila Prabhupada quotes from Brahma Sanghita, Srishti Sthiti Pralaya Sadhana Shaktireka. So she, through her agency, there is creation, maintenance and destruction. Please don't take photos now. I'll pose for you later if you want. Not now. Please lend your ears. Please listen. But why should this be? What is the need for it? It seems there shouldn't be any need. There are so many wars going on in the world today. It used to be a convention that one country would declare a war on others, but now they don't. They just go and start killing them. Yeah. Okay, I'll move again. Then you can move the mic again. It seems that we should be able to... Why don't we just work it all out, you know, but get the... Some reasonable people can come together. The leaders of different countries can come together and talk it out and work out the issues, and then we could all live peacefully together. What's the problem? There are underlying factors. The atheists might say, that the new atheists, as they call themselves, might say, well, it's something in our genes. We're genetically programmed. Not really programmed, because there's no programmer, but it just appears like that, to fight and kill and so on. Well, from Bhagavad Gita, we learn that there are two kinds of people, dho bhuto sarge lokesmin daiva asura evacha. Two kinds of people are the godly and the ungodly, and the symptoms of the ungodly is one of the symptoms is that they engage in activities which are unbeneficial for the world, jagat ahitaha. And another symptom is that they are paradukasuki. They take pleasure in giving pain to, and they actually take pleasure in giving pain to others. And there is the ishvaroham symptom of the materialist, ishvaroham mahambhogi. The mentality of each materialist, which means every living being who has come to this world, is that I am the controller and I am the enjoyer. Srila Prabhupada commented in a letter to some of his disciples who were quarreling among themselves, but this is applicable to the broader contexts also. Srila Prabhupada wrote that the reason why there is difficulty and competitive spirit is that everyone wants to be supreme. So why should one country try to rule another or subdue another? It's an extension of the attitude that we want to be supreme. Individual or collective, I want to be supreme. It's not constitutionally possible for the jiva to be supreme. But when you get a lot of jivas all together who all want to be the supreme, then there's competition. And one wants to show that he's better than the other, or to dominate the other, the exploitive spirit. So the war comes because there's this desire to control others and to show oneself to be superior to others. And when others don't submit and just do what we want them to do, which is very unlikely in this world that anyone will just do whatever you want them to do, then there's anger, and we say, well, we'll force you. By anger, we want to force them. And this all comes from the bodily concept of life, with the idea that I am this body and I can enjoy through it. And then we have ato, griha, kshetra, sutapta, vitaya. One thinks in terms of I, me, and mine, janasya moho, yamaham, ameti. Thinks in terms of I, me, and mine in terms of the body. This is my body, I was born in a certain country, therefore this country is worth fighting for and dying for. People have the idea it's worth dying for your country, but this nationalism is instilled in people so that a few people who will never go and fight for their country, they can enjoy. All the big rich people and the big powerful people, they're sitting peacefully enjoying and making money out of the war and sending all the foolish soldiers who think that they are fighting for the country. There's this whole Indian independence movement, and the Indians, they got the satisfaction, instead of being exploited by British demons, they could be exploited by Indian demons. It's all exploitation, that's all. The few people, they by various machinations, they exploit the many. So this bodily concept of life, I am this body, I'm meant to enjoy through this body. And yeah, people may think, well, if that's the point to enjoy this body, then why will people sacrifice their life? Because it's some perverted, for the country, so-called for the country, it's some perverted idea, it's a perversion of the principle of giving your life to Krishna. Instead, we'll give our life to our country. Of course, there may be the consideration that, well, if the Indian demons, they may be more merciful to our people than the British were. They may or may not be. Or that at least we can live more peacefully, or something like this. There's the idea. There's always the idea in a war that things were, we're doing this war to, people are willing to sacrifice their lives because we're going to make things better. Revolutions come about because people think we'll make things better. We need to kill a few people and then things will be better. That's the idea. So what's actually going on is this, underlying it all, people don't realize there is the bodily concept of life and all our illicit desires, which are all orchestrated so that people come together in one country and they attack another country. And in this way, people's various sinful desires, they're all channeled into killing others or being killed themselves. Again, we're not totally against war, because it is sometimes necessary, but a lot of it isn't also. So why does it come to this stage? Why can't we just sit down and talk it all out and make some compromise? Well, one major reason for that is animal slaughter, the forces of karma. By organizing mechanized torture and killing of animals, then we set ourselves up karmically for slaughtering others and being slaughtered by others. Srila Prabhupada writes, "The material world is itself a place always full of anxieties, and by encouraging animal slaughter, the whole atmosphere becomes polluted more and more by war, pestilence, famine, and many other unwanted calamities." So animal slaughter is being promoted and encouraged by governments all over the world. So we can't expect any auspiciousness. In another purport, Srila Prabhupada writes that karmis are envious of one another. That's materialistic outlook. Ishwaroham, I am the controller. Aham bhogi, I am the enjoyer. But when they desire to be the controller and the enjoyer, but when they perceive practically that they're not, or someone's enjoying and controlling more than me, then they become envious of each other. Or even if someone is in a superior situation to others, he may also be envious of someone who's enjoying even at a lesser level. They don't want them to enjoy at all. Why should they have any enjoyment? All the enjoyment should be for me. So Srila Prabhupada writes, "Karmis are envious of one another. Simply for sense gratification, they can kill thousands of animals. Simply for sense gratification. There's no need to kill animals for food. But they like it." Srila Prabhupada, seeing the meat eating on the plains, they just give a little meat. On each person's plate, there's a little meat, Srila Prabhupada commented. But for that purpose, so everyone can have a little meat, then there's thousands of animals are killed. And the reaction will be there also. From another purport, "Those who kill animals and give unnecessary pain, as people do in slaughterhouses, will be killed in a similar way in the next life and in many lives to come. One can never be excused from such an offense. If one kills many thousands of animals in a professional way so that other people can purchase the meat to eat, one must be ready to be killed in a similar way in his next life and in life after life. There are many rascals who violate their own religious principles. According to Judeo-Christian scriptures, it is clearly said, 'Thou shalt not kill.' Nonetheless, giving all kinds of excuses, even the heads of religions indulge in killing animals while trying to pass as saintly persons." Heads of religion, Srila Prabhupada writes here, indulge in killing animals. Well, it's understood that this means that they may not personally kill the animals, but they're involved in the killing of animals by sanctioning it and by eating the meat of the animals. "This mockery and hypocrisy in human society bring about unlimited calamities, therefore occasionally there are great wars. Masses of such people go out onto battlefields and kill themselves. Presently they have discovered the atomic bomb, which is simply waiting to be used for wholesale destruction. If people want to be saved from the killing business life after life, they must take to Krishna consciousness and cease sinful activity. The International Society for Krishna Consciousness recommends that everyone abandon meat-eating, illicit sex, intoxication, and gambling. When one gives up these sinful activities, he can understand Krishna and take to this Krishna Consciousness movement. We therefore request everyone to abandon sinful activity and chant the Hare Krishna mantra. In this way, people can save themselves from repeated birth and death and from being killed like the animals in slaughterhouses." People won't believe this. They They can't see the connection between the slaughter in war, or even not only of just soldiers. Nowadays, it's the collateral damage, which means destroying civilian houses, which you didn't really mean to, and often the people within them also. That's just considered part of modern warfare. Previously, the Kshatriyas would fight. In Europe also, it was supposed to be the fighting class that would fight. That description was there that a farmer would be farming his crops, and in the next field the soldiers are fighting. And he doesn't care who wins. It doesn't make any difference to him. Whoever wins the battle, he'll pay his taxes to. And the taxes are fixed according to Shastra also. So he doesn't care. They can fight and kill each other as much as they like. And he's a Vaishya. He has different service to do. So it doesn't make any difference to him. The people, they don't see the difference. That, well, nowadays killing citizens is a normal thing in battle. Srila Prabhupada described in World War I there was some martial FOCH, I don't know how it's pronounced, maybe it's pronounced Foch, Fok, Folk, or some name. He took position which had previously been held by Germans, and he had thousands of women and all of a sudden he found himself with thousands of women and children who he had to provide for. Previously they were under occupied German rule. And he thought, I can't provide for all these people on the battlefield. They were his own people. The people who he was fighting the war for. So he ordered them all killed by machine gunning them. There you go. You know, we can't provide for them. It's just a burden. We're supposed to be fighting a war, not looking after a bunch of women and children. So line them all up and very efficiently machine gun them to death. Of course, in those days, the machine guns weren't so efficient as they are now, but they were efficient enough to do the job. So, that's it. Slaughter. Very efficiently, slaughtering. Now, just a little aside here, going slightly off topic. Srila Prabhupada stating that we are not envious of butchers. We're not particularly on a campaign against butchers. It came in the news in New Zealand in the 1970s that some Hare Krishna devotees had been killed when a bomb that they were making, homemade bomb, went off. That bomb was meant for blowing up a slaughterhouse. But Prabhupada said we shouldn't blow up slaughterhouses. It's not our job to do that. And if the government decides, if by our preaching the government decides to blow up the slaughterhouse, then we may blow it up. But it's not. And Prabhupada said, what's the point? You're not going to stop animal slaughter by blowing up slaughterhouses. So, Srila Prabhupada is saying that we're not particularly against butchers. We're not on a campaign specifically about butchers. I'll read from, this is in 1968, Srila Prabhupada's talking about the six Goswamis of Vrindavan. They were very popular among all classes of men. Dhira, Dhira, Janapriyo, Priyakaro, because they were also benefactor. They were doing something which is beneficial to the mass of people. Dhira, Dhira, Janapriyo, Priyakaro, Nirmatsaro. Nirmatsaro means not envious. We are not envious to anyone. Yesterday I received one letter from Rai Ram, who at that time was the editor of Back to Godhead. He wanted my permission to make some propaganda in our magazine, Back to Godhead, against animal slaughter, butchery. So I replied that why should we be against a class of men who are known in this society as butchers? Now, of course, Srila Prabhupada did say that where people need to be educated, that illicit sex, meat eating, gambling, and intoxication are sinful. But he didn't want to specifically pinpoint butchers per se. Why? Well, that is explained in the next statement, which I'll read from this, what Srila Prabhupada said here. Actually, everyone is a butcher. Actually, so-called men who are supporting these butchers, they're also butchers. According to Manu Sanghita, there are 8 kinds of butchers. The man who is killing the animal, the man who is ordering to kill the animal, the man who is skinning the animal, the man who is purchasing the meat, the man who is cooking, the man who is eating. They're all called butchers. Just like if there is a murder case and there is conspiracy, so it is not only the man who has directly killed some person, he is arrested, but everyone who is in the conspiracy, they're all arrested. That is the common law. So, in that case, everyone is a butcher. Besides that, because a person is killing some cow or some animal, we are calling a butcher, but mostly they're killing their soul. Anyone who is unconscious, who is ignorant of his spiritual identity, identifying himself with this body, and misusing this opportunity of the human form of life simply for animal sense gratification, they're also butchers. If killing of some living entity is butchery, then how great a butcher is he who is killing himself? One person is killing an animal, but someone else is killing himself, atmaha, self-killing, out of ignorance. Everyone is in ignorance. Any sinful activity is done out of ignorance. So ignorance is no excuse. The butcher is killing animals because he just does not know what is the effect of this killing. Similarly, persons who do not know what is the value of this human form of life and are simply spoiling it just like animals, they are also butchering themselves. So Prabhupada said everyone is a butcher. So getting back to this point about warfare, attacking innocent citizens, Srila Prabhupada wrote that in modern warfare, attacks are made upon innocent citizens who are without fault. According to the law of Manu, such warfare is a most sinful activity. Furthermore, at the present moment, civilized nations are unnecessarily maintaining many slaughterhouses for killing innocent animals. When a nation is attacked by its enemies, the wholesale slaughter of the citizens should be taken as a reaction to their own sinful activities. So wars happen because of, as reactions to sinful activities. That's from a purport of Srila Prabhupada in the 4th canto. Srila Prabhupada wrote in another purport that sending cows to slaughterhouses is the most sinful activity in human society. So the citizens are sinful because they cooperate, they're all collaborators in the slaughterhouse civilization. Animals are sent to slaughterhouses, especially killing cows is very sinful. But yet, Srila Prabhupada talks about attacks upon innocent citizens. Well, they're not really innocent, are they? If they're all partaking in the slaughterhouse civilization. We can understand that in the particular context, then they may appear to be innocent, and Srila Prabhupada uses that term. They're not directly involved in the fighting, but they become victims of missiles which are sent, or drones is the latest thing, computerized killing machines. Regarding the innocent citizen, there was an article in Back to Godhead magazine in 1982 by Jyotikama Prabhu, one of my all-time favorite Back to Godhead articles, although I haven't been reading the Back to Godhead regularly for quite a few years now. This was at a time in the history of this tiny planet, which mostly people are unaware of now, and probably in India they were never aware of it, most people, unless they were particularly well informed. It was at a time when in Europe and America it was widely considered that nuclear war is inevitable and that will be the end of modern civilization as we know it. And we may also destroy the whole human race and the whole planet, because between America and the USSR, there were enough nuclear warheads. Warhead is the thing they stick on the head of a missile, the part that counts when it lands on your head. There was enough to destroy the world, I don't know, 10 times over or something like this. They had more nuclear missiles than were required. Why they went on making more and more, I'm not exactly sure. If you have enough to destroy the whole planet, then why make more? Just to make sure, maybe. But it was a bleak time in which people felt very hopeless, that there's no hope. It must happen. There was this feeling that sooner or later, someone in Moscow or someone in Washington, D.C. is going to press the button and that will start it all off. And then the missiles will come over and they'll be shot down by anti-missiles. But then the anti-anti-missiles will get them, and then the anti-anti-anti-missiles. But then eventually some of them will get, maybe that's why they, eventually some of them will get through, and then we'll all be dead. So, from this article, the Dhrutakama Prabhu, the author, posed the rhetorical question, can we really expect that another conference, another summit meeting, more demonstration will cause wars to vanish? This peace meetings, hold a candle up for peace, observe, silent, do meditation for peace. Transcendental meditation is supposed to make world peace. Do a yajna for peace. Come together, all hold hands together in a circle. And all these things are supposed to make peace in the world. But is it really going to make peace? Let's all, I tell you what, why don't we all get on a plane and go to Iraq and go and meet these, what's it called, Islamic State people, and we'll all hold hands with them. And they'll chop off our head. And it won't stop any wars. Is there another quote from this? Everyone's wailing about the irrationality of the national leaders, the big bad guys with their grubby fingers on the buttons, who for the sake of national pride and prestige are ready to invoke the full horrors of nuclear Armageddon upon millions of innocent citizens. It's really inspired writing. Armageddon is the war at the time of the end of the world according to the book of Revelations. It's the war to end all wars. That's what they called the First World War. Or was it the Second World War? Or is it going to be the Third World War? The war to end all wars. But there's no war to end all wars. The idea is okay, we'll win this war and then we're good civilized people. So there won't be any more wars after that. We'll be in control and there won't be any more wars after that. Who's in control? That's another myth. So Dhrutakama Prabhu in his article talks about this is the central myth of the whole nuclear disarmament movement. There's this idea, let's just dismantle all these nuclear weapons. That is again in the Bible that comes that phrase of beating swords into plowshares. In other words, you have all these swords, so you take all the swords, because you've decided we're not going to have any more fighting, so you take all the swords and you mold the metal into plows for plowing the ground. So that's the idea. But this is the myth, Dhrutakama wrote, about innocent citizens. If you could just get the leaders to come together and shake hands and sign some papers, then it'll all be over, and we don't have to worry about anything. But it all may sound sane and rational, but it's based on a faulty analysis of the whole problem. The truth is that neither the US nor the USSR is a free agent. They are both acting under the influence of the inescapable law of karma. They're not, it's, we may say that, well, these big leaders, they think they're in control, but they're not. They're all operating under the law of karma. Prakriti kriyamanani gunai karmani sarvashaha. Ahankara vimurha ma kartaham iti manyate. The example is there of samsara davanala, the blazing forest fire. Which, how does it start? Well, in the heat of the summer, the wind may blow two bamboo trees together, and they're blowing, they're rubbing against each other, rubbing, they're dry, and by the friction, some fire comes, and then the whole forest goes up in a great conflagration. So it just appears, it's just some random happening by chance. But it's not by chance. It's under the laws of, everything is going on under the laws of God. So the wind that blows and brings together the rubbing, the friction, that the little friction, and then it becomes more and more and more. What is that wind in cosmic terms? That is the reactions of sinful activities, the law of karma. You can't see it. It would be, after a forest fire, it would be very difficult to try to trace where exactly it began or how exactly it began. But we can understand that there are subtle principles. We may not be, it may be very, so subtle, they're very difficult for us to exactly pinpoint, like time. It's very, what exactly, how does time work? But we know it's there, but it's very subtle and difficult to understand. But the basic principle, as in time, we understand there's past, present, and future. So we understand that the laws of karma work because there is, just as in the laws of thermodynamics, for every action there is an equal and opposite reaction. So on the karmic level also, if we perform some sinful activity, there's a reaction for that. If we perform a pious activity, there's a reaction for that. It may not be immediately obvious. It may be very subtle. It may be that someone who acts very sinfully, but they also do some pious activities, and they get some pious, they get pious results mostly first, and then later on the sinful results. So we wonder what's going on. But for sure, sinful acts, they generate sinful reactions. When we understand the law of karma, we can understand that the wars, they're not caused so much because of different leaders as by ourselves. Not ourselves in this case, but the innocent citizens. Our eating meat, voting for leaders who do not close the slaughterhouses. We also become involved in sinful reactions. Maybe that's a good argument to vote, but then which leader is going to stop slaughterhouses? Maybe this government will, hopeful, but the last BJP government opened more slaughter, there were more slaughterhouses opened than in the time of any recent government. They were slaughterhouse friendly. The Prime Minister was a meat-eating Brahmin. So we may think just a little bit of meat, and then I just eat a little bit of meat. How can I be responsible? How can I be held responsible for these horrible activities in which so many people are killed and there's so much fear and suffering and crying? Go have a look in a slaughterhouse and see how much suffering is there. It's horrific. It's not trivial. And not just the slaughterhouse, the way the animals are treated throughout their life, those that survive, just like the chickens that are allowed to be born, those which are not, the eggs which are not sent for sale for people to eat, The chicken, half of them are just thrown away and killed immediately, the male ones, the ones that hatch. I remember a few years ago there was this bird flu, and the threat of bird flu. So the news came that, yesterday in Maharashtra, over 1 lakh chickens had been killed to stop the spread of bird flu. I said, 1 lakh of chickens? But anyway, they're being killed. Anyway, they were going to get killed. Some years ago, I made a calculation. At that time, the population of India was about 1 billion. What's that? 100 crores. So if you conservatively estimate that one chicken is killed per day for every 100 people in India, then you come out with 1 crore chicken, or even if you take for every 1,000 people, then you still get 10 lakhs, 1 million chickens killed every day. It's not a small number, is it? That's a very conservative estimate, seeing as chicken is the most popular form of flesh food. It's got to be reacted. The way they're tortured throughout their life, it's just a chicken. There are no laws to protect. There are some laws in some countries to protect animals from being mistreated, or at least that they should be slaughtered in what they call a humane way, although I never really understood what it means to humanely slaughter an animal. Just like if I tell someone, well, now we're going to slaughter you, we're going to kill you, but don't worry, we're going to do it humanely. It won't hurt. The very fact that people can talk about humane slaughter of animals shows how inhuman they are. No, anyone who had any feeling would not allow this or not support this. The people who eat the meat, they say, well, I didn't kill anyone. Just like Buddhists in Thailand, where I used to, they say, oh, we're Buddhists, we don't kill any animals, but they keep a class of butchers who kill all the animals for them. So we don't kill animals, we only eat them. But the animals wouldn't be killed if they weren't eager to eat them. So according to the laws of Manu, they're just as guilty. Quoting from Srila Prabhupada again, those who kill animals and give them unnecessary pain as people do in slaughterhouses will be killed in a similar way in the next life and in many lives to come. One can never be excused from such an offense. There are many rascals who violate... I already read that, didn't I? Already, anyway, let's read it again. There are many rascals who violate their own religious principles. Judeo-Christian scriptures clearly say, thou shalt not kill. Nevertheless, even the heads of religion giving all kinds of excuses indulge in killing animals while trying to pass as saintly persons. This mockery and hypocrisy in human society bring about unlimited calamities. Therefore, occasionally there are great wars. Masses of people go out onto the battlefields and kill each other. It's a bit different nowadays. It's not so much masses of people going, but war has become more localized. It comes in small packets. But if you put all the packets together, it comes to a lot of killing and suffering. Abortions. That's also generates so much sinful reaction. How many abortions? I didn't look on the internet to see how many abortions they estimate throughout the world in a year. You won't know for sure because it's not all enumerated. What's the word? It's not all documented, datified. A lot of it isn't. In India, it must be. How much? How many? Lakhs and lakhs. Abortion clinics is a thriving business in this country. Very sinful. So in 1982, when this article came out, they said there were 50 million a year throughout the world. In America, it's over 1 million, that which are noted, which are statisticized. Sinful reaction must come. Srila Prabhupada, in one conversation, he noted that he conversation with his disciples, he spoke about a conversation he'd had with a lawyer previously, in which this lawyer was against war. But when I asked him if you were a meat eater, he said, yes. That's what we eat, that's food. And most people never think about it. I know myself, growing up in England, eating meat, I never thought there was anything wrong with it. Everyone does it. Everyone eats meat. And just before I had the time even to think about what is right and wrong, I was already habituated to eating meat. It's just, that's what everyone does. You don't think whether it's right or wrong. How can there be anything wrong with it when everyone does it? And good people do it also. The priest in the church does it. At that time, there was no question about it. And vegetarians were very few, and they were considered to be nutcases. So Srila Prabhupada noted, if the poor animals can become your food, then the big nation can say, the small nation is my food. If might is right, because we can dominate the animals, therefore we can kill them and eat them, then the same mentality comes that one nation is more powerful than another, so we should control them and do what we like. And if they don't agree to do what we want to do, then we'll damn well bomb them into doing what they should do, which is what we want them to do. Another reason why the might make rights principles. That's the general mentality. This is enacted by politicians. We say, well, the politicians, they make the wars. And actually that's widely considered at the present time. There's undeclared wars or semi-declared war. Just started again another round of war in Iraq, if you can still refer to Iraq, because what used to be the country of Iraq is now being unilaterally bitten off and made into a new country, not recognized by the United Nations. But they don't care that they're not recognized by the United Nations. In fact, they don't care for anyone or anything. the next round of bombing Iraq is going on, which clearly everyone understands is not going to, if they perceive a problem in this so-called Islamic State, they're not going to solve any problems. If they're afraid of terrorism, it's almost certainly going to increase the propensity of these people to be terroristic against them. If you leave them alone, they might not bother you so much. But if you start bombing them, they're more likely to become inimical toward you, to act inimically toward you. So you can say, you may wonder, well, why the politicians? Why do they do such stupid things? The whole policy of the United States in the Middle East since the time of the Elder Bush, it just seems so stupid, because actually going back, well, how far do you want to go back? I mean, there's the British in Afghanistan in the 19th century. It's a long history of trying to control that region, which they haven't been able to do. And no one ever able to control Afghanistan, because it's not really a country anyways. The people, the different tribes living in different areas, and they never cared for the government in Kabul. And they just fight amongst each other. Same in Burma, so-called country Burma. It's the central area, the Irrawaddy region, that the river Irrawaddy, that's the flat land, that's where the Burmese live. And all around, there are mountains and jungles, and there are Shins and Shans and Karens and Kachins and all different tribes. And they don't care about the Burmese government. They never submitted to the government in Rangoon. So these are theoretical countries, so they're going on fighting for generations and generations. Anyway, policy of the United States, it just seems so stupid. They can't control. They should learn from history, although the only thing that history teaches is that we don't learn from history. We're supposed to learn from history, but the only thing that history teaches us is that we never learn from history. We always make the same mistakes again and again and again. So this policy of trying to control that area and dominate it Well, some success. They got control of at least the oil fields in Kuwait for the time being under their control. But Iraq, they for all their bombing and everything, they still couldn't bring it under control. And but what they're doing is they're creating, anyway, the people of that area don't like non-Muslims in general. There's a general feeling of animosity, and they've fanned it up so that it will go on for generations and generations. The bad feeling of the Muslims in that area, in particular, toward the people who come and buy. Naturally, they're not going to feel very friendly toward people who send bombs and drones and missiles. So it just seems like completely stupid against the American national interest. Why should they do that? I mean, if an ordinary person like me, with no expertise in such matters, can understand that it's a terrible policy, especially for even in the short term, and what to speak of the long term, then why do they do it? Well, it's called Prakriti Kriyama. You may say, why am I talking all these things? Well, let's bring it back to Shastra. Prakriti kriyamanani gunai karmani sarvashah ahankara vimurhatma kartaha miti manyate. They're controlled by material nature. But they think that we are in control. And they have to show that we're in control. Especially the elder Bush, he was, there was all this propaganda that he's a wimp, which means a cowardly kind of person who has no strength. So he had to make a war to show that he's actually very strong. So, and not that he's doing anything, all he has to do is to order it. But he didn't want to get a reputation, I guess, like Jimmy Carter, who was seen as completely hopeless when American embassy was taken over after the Islamic Revolution in Iran, and Americans were held hostages. Then Jimmy Carter sent in some American troops to try and save them, but it was a complete fiasco. It was badly planned and badly executed. They didn't even get to Tehran. They got caught up in a storm in the desert, and the only result was that they lost one helicopter, I believe, and one American life, and they didn't save anyone. So then Reagan came in, and immediately, as soon as he was voted in, immediately Iran released them. The idea that Reagan was a strong guy and he wouldn't take any nonsense. So politicians have to keep up their image of being very strong. They won't take any nonsense. We'll show them America's the most powerful. We're not finished yet. They have to show them all this. It's also widely believed that the politicians, they're under the control of the big moneyed elements of the world, and they have to execute their order. What is good for the big moneyed people who you don't even know their names mostly. They're anonymously pulling the strings. So we're told. Another reason, politicians making wars. It's good business and it's good politics. Good business means that one missile which they're going to drop is going to... Not exactly drop, they're guided. They're not just, we used to have the idea of dropping bombs. It was a very haphazard activity. Yeah, in the Second World War, they'd drop bombs and they'd try and get them on target just by dropping them from a plane. Seems pretty primitive nowadays where they have missiles which are guided exactly to their target. So even some not top-of-the-line missile can cost at least $1 million. And when you're letting them off like firecrackers after a party, then it comes to a lot of money. It's big business. And wars cost a lot of money, and it means you have to... It boosts up the economy, and then when things get all damaged, then you can go in and repair it, and then that's also business. It's all business. There's no business like war business. Then another reason, Srila Prabhupada suggested in a conversation, is that The American government has seen all these. This is in 1971, when the Vietnam War was going on. And the young men were being drafted into the army. They got a letter, and then they have to go, and they get their chest measured, and they have a medical checkup, and then they get sent off to Vietnam. And Prabhupada said, why? One reason that they made this Vietnam War, which no one could understand, there ain't no time to wonder why we're all going to die, is that there's all these hippies, and they're completely useless people. They're just loitering on the street, nothing to do, making anti-war campaigns, smoking marijuana, and they're just an embarrassment for the nation and for the government. So send them off to Vietnam and kill them all. That's what Prabhupada suggested. Let's get rid of the hippie problem. Let the Viet Cong kill them all. How about that? Interesting observation from His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. So, do the politicians make the wars? In one sense, yes, but in another sense, they're impelled by Maya. It may be that they have good motives. Yeah, we have to fight for the right, do the right thing, just like the Crusades. The one reason why the Muslims are against the Western or the Christians is because there were the Crusades from Europe. How many were there? 12 or 13 over several hundred years. From Europe, all people would go and attack Jerusalem, which is under Islamic control, and they fought, and then sometimes they took it over, and then they'd be thrown out again, and they just attacked again and again and again. And they thought they were doing the right thing, but from the Muslims' point of view, they weren't doing the right thing, they were doing the wrong thing. So everyone, they may be thinking, we're doing the right thing. We have to do our duty. We have to go out and fight and kill or be killed. But a misplaced understanding of what is right or wrong, and wrong, or the idea of nationalism, die for the country, the politicians or anything, we're doing it for the welfare of the country. But what is this country anyway? It's just someone drew some lines on a map. And if you're born on one side of a map, you're a citizen. One side of the line on a map, you're a citizen of some country. And if you're on the other side, then you're a citizen of another country. And it's just, in many cases, arbitrary. In other cases, not. I mean, India is a distinct country. There's no doubt about it. Even the modern nation of India is a distinct country, as is Britain, for instance, the geographical area, although it's divided into England and Scotland and Ireland. It's distinct because of the landmass, or even France, some of the borders are distinct, the maritime borders and the what are those mountains called, the Pyrenees, which the mountains which separate them from Spain, the borders with Germany, Belgium, Luxembourg, they're less distinct, but anyway, there's people speaking more or less the same language with more or less the same culture in more or less the same area for, well, at least 1,500 years, more than that. So, all right, you can say France is a country, but then again, it's meaningless because you're born and then you die and you think this is my country, but as Srila Prabhupada often pointed out, that before you were born there, the country was there, and after you die, the country will be there. Just like America, the country, they're fighting for America, but the American people who consider themselves the American people inhabiting that country, they weren't there. 400 years ago, the nation of America simply didn't exist. So this idea of nationalism, the politicians, they promote nationalism. That politicians, they are causes of war, can be also, from another perspective, the Machiavellian perspective. There was a Italian, of course at the time there was no Italy as such, there were different little states fighting with each other, surprise, surprise. But Machiavelli was what would nowadays be called an Italian, who wrote a book called The Prince. It would have a different title in Italian, in which the most famous statements, how to administer a state for a prince or a king or whatever, in which probably his most famous advice is that the leader of the state should always have an external enemy. If there's no external enemy, invent one. And keep the country all the time in a state of war, or at least almost ready to go to war. In that way, you'll unite all the people, and then they won't make trouble for you. If they're not galvanized together to fight some external threat, there may not be an external threat, but politically you need one. So if you're not galvanized to threats, then they'll start looking at you, the leader, and all the things that you're doing wrong, and they'll come up together against you. So it forges national unity and diverts attention away from the wrongdoings of the leader, and that way you can also manipulate them and control them. That, well, if you don't do what I say, then it'll weaken the country, and then the whoever they are from outside will come and attack us and kill us. So it's great policy to control the people, and it's some more thoughtful people, not spiritually thoughtful, but politically thoughtful people, think that that's largely what's going on in the West at the present time. They have a political need to perpetuate fighting in the Middle East, and therefore they've invented this massively over-exaggerated the threat of terrorism in the Western world. Fortuitously for them, this 9/11 attacks happened, and many people actually think it was actually an inside job, but if it did happen without the awareness of the American government, it was just a perfect excuse for them to invade Afghanistan in the name of searching for Osama bin Laden. So we don't know what these demons are doing. They may be doing, we don't know. There's the concept of false flags, where government itself attacks its own people or its own military operations and blames it on someone they want to attack. And then they attack them. And Pearl Harbor, which started the American involvement in the Pacific arena of the Second World War, is often thought to be a false flag attack, as is 9/11, and so on, and so on, and so on. So politicians, yeah, in Kali Yuga, politicians are demons. They're supposed to be saintly people. The fighters should be, or the kshatriyas should be saintly people, but they're mostly demons. Or even if you say, well, they come from ordinary backgrounds, as the present Prime Minister of India is well known to come from a very ordinary background, a seller of tea seller, not even wholesale, but not a big bunnia, but just selling chai one cup at a time. Maybe he could ask him to reinstate the clay pots and give this instead of all these polluting plastic cups, but I guess he's gone beyond the level of a tea seller. He's got bigger things to think about. That would actually help him in the Cleaning Up India campaign that he started, which is a good campaign, actually. So they may start with, they may come from a very ordinary kind of background, but to be in that position, you have to operate for the benefit of all these big money powers, and you have to be in this consciousness of my country versus their country, and so on, and so on, and so on. So what should we do to stop the fighting? Have all these wars? Give peace a chance! John Lennon's famous song, all we are saying is give peace a chance. Yes. Hare Krishna got mentioned in that song also. Well, what has Srila Prabhupada said then? Srila Prabhupada says in this regard, fighting you cannot stop. Many people are thinking how to stop war. That is impossible. It is a nonsense proposal. It cannot be. Because the fighting spirit is there in everyone. That is a symptom of the living entity. Even children, they have no politics or no enmity, but they fight for 5 minutes, again they are friends. So the fighting spirit is there. So fighting will go on. Of course, there is a solution, which is Bhoktaram Yajna Tapasam Sarvaloka Maheshwaram Suhridam Sarva Bhutanam Gyatva Mang Shantim Richati. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna gives the peace formula for individual personal peace of mind, or how an individual become personal, but Srila Prabhupada gave it as a peace formula for the whole of society. If we simply recognize that Krishna is the supreme enjoyer, we're not meant to enjoy this world, so we shouldn't fight over it. Krishna is the supreme controller, so we should stop controlling or trying to control. Krishna is the supreme friend of every living being, so we shouldn't make enmity with anyone. So this is the way to bring peace in the world. Well, what about the United Nations? That was formed to stop any more wars. Srila Prabhupada commented about that, that the United Nations is attempting to establish peace in the world, but they cannot stop war. War breaks out again and again. After the First World War, statesmen and diplomats manufactured the League of Nations. The idea was to, before situations become so tense, we'll talk together and work it all out, and we'll stop war. No one really understands why the First World War started. What was the great need for it? In the Second World War, it was understood that Hitler was, well, he was attacking one country after another, and when he attacked Poland, it got too much. And though, I guess it wouldn't have made that much difference to Britain and France and all those countries if they hadn't retaliated, if Poland came under the control of the Germans. But anyway, they decided to fight. But in the First World War, it's not exactly clear what the political motive for it was, but it was samsara dhavanala. That's what it was. Then the Second World War came, and now they have devised the United Nations, but war is still going on. The actual goal is to stop war, but that cannot be done. By one action, war is created, and by another action, war is stopped for the time being. But again, at the next opportunity, there is another war. The cycle of sinful activities and atonement is like that. What we actually want is to be free from suffering and war, but that does not happen. One kind of war causes a disturbance, and another kind of war stops it for some time, but that is not the ultimate solution to the problem. These troubles happen due to ignorance. So this Krishna Consciousness Movement's contribution to world peace is giving knowledge of Krishna consciousness and chanting the Hare Krishna mantra to purify the atmosphere. Okay, so now no more wars. First of all, we have to stop all the quarreling within the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, and then we can go out in the world and tell them we have the peace solution. We have it theoretically, but we are fairly civilized within our movement. It hasn't been, well, there has even been some instance of killing and this and that, but murder, but not much compared to the broader population. Within a society of, it's spread all over the world, it could be practically expected in the modern age that someone's going to kill someone else at some point in time, seeing as there are so many murders all over the world. So we are, at least in terms of physical violence, quite a peaceful society, I would say. So among Brahmins, verbal fighting is quite acceptable, but not physical fighting. So, any question or comment? I guess, actually, you should all go and take prasadam, I guess. I should give you some prasadam, because you have to break fast in time. Anything? Yeah.
How do you
Kshatriya has the Ishvara Bhava and wants to rule over people. Then he's allowed to rule. If he thinks he can rule over better than someone else, well, he's allowed to. He can attack. But generally that would not be considered dharmic to attack another kingdom unless there were clear discrepancies in the discharge of duties by the Kshatriya in a neighboring kingdom. He can also bring the neighboring king under control and exact tribute from him, as Yudhishthira did by sending out the horses, challenge horses. And then if someone wanted to capture that horse, then the Yudhishthira, not directly, but under his brothers, they would fight to free that horse. And if they couldn't free it, then that king would remain unsubdued. But in the course of fighting over that horse, the king may die also. So he may exact the king may submit himself to an emperor and pay tribute to him also. Yeah.
Lord Shiva is responsible for the moral ignorance, but lust, anger, aggression are all under characteristic of moral passion. So how do we understand?
Lust is a product of karma, and krodha is uncontrolled anger, is when karma becomes transformed into wrath, then that's a symptom of ignorance. Passion, rajas and tamas. The tamas predominating. Tamagun doesn't mean only dullness. Another manifestation of tamagun is destruction, meaningless destruction. There's the passive form of tamas and the active form. Hare Krishna.